We're holding on page Mem Dalad in Bava Basra, or it's Dalad. The Mishnah talks about the subject of this perek is basically, it's the name of it, is Ashutfin, and it talks about different details about people who own a chotzer in partnership or own different property in partnership, and you have a number of dinim as far as the division of it, as far as what each of them is entitled to demand from the other one, to improvements for it, etc. So the Gemara mentions that the Mishnah mentions that you have the typical arrangement in those days where you had a bunch of houses opening into a chotzer. So the Mishnah had said that the people, the various people who live around that chotzer are entitled to require each other to contribute to money for building a base shahr for the chotzer. A base shahr is a gatehouse, like you have nowadays. A lot of times by some places, you'll have a little building over there with a security guard in it. So a base shahr would be something similar so that not everybody can just wander into the chotzer or peek inside or whatever. So the Mishnah says that they can force each other to contribute towards the funds for that. So the Gemara asks, so you're telling me that putting up a base shahr is a good thing. However, we find Hochasidah, there was a case of a certain chosid, so the Gemara mentions in some places that wherever it says chosid echad means either Rabbi Yehuda ben Rabbi Loi or Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, maybe it's the same thing over here, or maybe the expression Hochasidah is different. Whatever the case, he was a chosid, he acted l'fnim mishur sadin, and he was zoicha to gilu Eliyahu, davar rogel to kamishro Eliyahu ba'ade. He was accustomed to Eliyahu, would regularly come and talk with him. Bona base shahr, but then he built a base shahr, a gatehouse, for his chotzer, v'loishro ba'ade, and Eliyahu no longer came to talk with him. Why? Because then it prevents that now poor people come. Up until now, they could come to the entrance of the chotzer, or even into the chotzer, and call out that they need tzedakah, and the chosid echon and his neighbors would be able to come and give them tzedakah. Now, as a result of the base shahr, especially if there is a security guard in there, then they can't do that anymore. So therefore, so Eliyahu is, among other things, the idea is Eliyahu wants people to act l'fnim mishuras hadin and to do chesed, and now he's not, and therefore Eliyahu resents that. We find Iyun Yaakov points out he himself provided food for a poor widow, the Ishat Sofasis, when he stayed by her, and now he doesn't like the idea when people don't provide food for the poor. Another vote is, we're going to learn later on, when we get to talking all about tzedakah, the Gemara mentions the concept that tzedakah is makareves as a ge'ula, and that's Eliyahu's job is to announce the ge'ula, and therefore when tzedakah is being interfered with, then Eliyahu resents that. So therefore, the point of the question is, in other words, how can the neighbors force one another to contribute towards a base shahr when we see that putting up a base shahr is not a good thing? So there's a parenthetical note here added in Rashi here in Ein Yaakov, because the Ein Yaakov over here doesn't continue with what the Gemara says. The Gemara makes several distinctions between a good base shahr and a bad one. There's a difference whether it's inside the chotzer or outside it. If it's outside, for example, according to most Rishonim, the point is that the poor person can still come into the base shahr and come all the way to the entrance of the chotzer itself and call out, and people will hear him, as opposed to if the base shahr is on the inside, he can't go into the base shahr itself, they won't let him, so therefore he has to stand outside it and call out, and therefore they're not going to hear him, and instead they're not going to hear him because the base shahr will block him. And the Gemara goes into several other distinctions, whether there's a guard there or not, etc., whether the base shahr can be opened from the outside. So there's a number of distinctions the Gemara talks about. So the Mishnah would be talking about that the neighbors can compel one another to contribute to a good base shahr. And that would had the Hahu Chasidah put up such a one, then Eliyahu wouldn't have had a problem with it. So a base shahr is a gatehouse, we're saying, the same way as nowadays. For example, sometimes you have different places, you'll have like a little booth with a security guard. So that's basically what a base shahr is. Similarly, you have, in some big buildings, right, you have a lobby with a security guard sitting there, and you have to pass by him and check in with him before you can go into the building. So a base shahr is basically the same kind of thing. Yeah. So there's an interesting discussion in this connection that's brought in the Art Scroll English Ein Yaakov. They bring an interesting point from one of the poskim of our times, Rabbi Yitzchok Zilberstein from Bnei Brak. They asked him, there was a people in a building wanted to put up an intercom system so people can't just come into the building because there had been a bit of an uptick in crime in the area. And should they do that? Because it's also going to prevent poor people from coming and asking for tzedakah. And he points out this is very much the same kind of thing as this din and as this situation in the Gemara over here. And he goes by Rikos and discusses the various ins and outs of it. Maybe they are allowed to because they're not required to hear an all Gemara. We're talking about Sahakal. What's going to happen if they don't put up the base shaft? They'll have people will intrude on their privacy a little bit, as opposed to over here. We're talking about they may actually suffer thefts. On the other hand, we have to look at what's the chances of it, how prevalent are they in the area. So there's a lot of different factors, and also whether was the Chosid Echad just not acting with Fenim Meshuras Adin, or is it actually something that the Gemara is saying that you shouldn't put up that kind of base shaw that will keep out the poor. So there's a lot of different factors that come into it. But it goes to show that, you have this kind of thing, and you have very much a real live kind of issue that you have nowadays with intercoms. That's the same kind of thing as what the Gemara is describing here. Further on, now the Mishnah also talked about that in the same way, people of the city are entitled to compel one another to contribute to various things that the city needs, including, for example, a city back then needed a wall, it needed people to defend it. So therefore, so everybody has to contribute to that. So now the Gemara tells Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya Roma Deshura Arabanan. Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya imposed a tax for the city wall, to build or repair the city wall, and he imposed it also on the chachamim of the city, just like on everybody else. Amalei Rav Shimon Lakish, so Rish Lakish tells him, you're doing wrong by that. Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitzirusa. The Talmidei Chachamim do not need protection. Their Torah and their Maisim Tovim protect them. Therefore, they don't need to contribute to the wall. Now there's quite a bit of discussion about that. What kind of Talmid Chacham are we talking about? Is it Davka one who's Todosei Umnosei, who's a full-time Talmid Chacham and does nothing else? Is it even maybe he's considered that even if he has some kind of job, but he does the minimum amount of it just in order to get himself a bare parnosa, and then the rest of his time he spends learning? The Rishonim also point out, since the Gemara in a couple of lines describes them also as tzaddikim, then that implies we can't just be talking about these are people who learn lots of Torah but don't have midas tovus and don't have good midas. If they are, then that's not the kind of Talmid Chacham we're talking about over here.
Check them when they're learning Torah.
No, so we're saying even when they're not learning, right now they may not, even a Talmid Chacham was Torosei Umnosei, there's still times when he's not learning Torah, he still has to sleep, he still has to eat, he still has to go to the bathroom. But nevertheless, their Torah protects them.
From what we perspective now, that Talmid Chacham that have a lot of good leaders.
If he does tshuva, that's different. But we're talking about as long as he's acting that way, right? So the Rabbanan don't need protection. Their Torah protects them. There is discussion about that. It's brought from the Chazon Ish that if the city is all Talmid Chachamim, then after all, they can't be soymech al hanes, and they do need a wall. But we're talking about, in other words, if the city has some Talmid Chachamim and some Amei Aretz, then the Amei Aretz are the ones who have to contribute, and the Talmid Chachamim should be exempt. The Chassam Sofer makes an interesting point in that regard. He says because the job of the Talmid Chachamim, they don't just sit and learn Torah for themselves. They teach the people. They're telling the people what to do and what not to do. And if the people would listen, then they would all deserve that protection from the Eivishter as well, and they wouldn't need a war at all. So if they choose not to listen, that's their fault, and they need to contribute towards the city's defenses. So Rav Shimon Lakish tells him, Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitzirusa. The Rabbanan, the Chachamim, do not need protection from this wall. Dichtiv, as the Pasuk says, until them, Esperem, I will count them mechil yubun. They would be more than the sand. Now, Tosfos points out the context of the Pasuk is that we're talking about Talmid Chachamim, that we're talking about Tzaddikim. But we have to ask, Esperem Maman, who does it mean? Who are we going to count? tzaddikim than a fish in mechala? Do we mean that we're going to count the tzaddikim and we would find they were more numerous than the sand? Or different gears of my esprit and mechal yurbun, inaim a tzaddikim? Does it mean when we say I'm going to count them and they'd be larger than the sand, does that mean the tzaddikim? How could that be? Hashta kulu yisrok, sibahu, kachol asher al sfasayam. The whole Jewish people, which includes tzaddikim and includes those who are not yet on that level, and it says that they will be, Hashem promises Avraham, that they will be like the sand that's on the seashore. So even the whole Jewish people are only equal to the sand, not greater than it. Tzaddikim de isbuhu nefishim echola, or tzaddikim asim mechel yurbun. How could you have that the tzaddikim, which are a subset of the Jewish people, should be more numerous than the sand? So what does it mean? Ela hachikamar, therefore, necessarily, the pasuk has to mean, esperem elu maaseim shal tzaddikim she'esperem, means I would count the individual maisim tovim of the tzaddikim. And when we count those up, mechel yurbun, those would indeed be greater than the amount of sand. The actual number of tzaddikim is smaller, but when you count up the number of maisim tovim that each tzaddik does, then you get to an enormous number greater than the number of sand grains. Now, says Rish Lakish to Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, now, based on that, we should be able to make a kal v'chomer and demonstrate then that you're wrong in imposing taxes for the city's defenses on the Talmid Chachamim. The sand, which is a small amount, megan alayam, and it protects the sea from overflooding the land. As we have psukim, we're going to later on in the Masechta, when we have the stories of Rav Baba Chana, the Gemara quotes there a pasuk from Yirmiyah, and there's several psukim along these lines in different places in Tanakh, that Hashem set a rule for the sea: you may not overflood the land, and there's sand there by the seashore as a barrier that you may not cross. So that small amount of sand on the beach is enough to protect. Is enough to protect the sea from overflooding us. Maaseim shel tzaddikim. So then the deeds of the tzaddikim, which we just said, the pasuk in Tehillim is telling us that they're more than the sand. Shein merubim. They're even more than that. Alachas kama v'kama. How much more so that they protect them, that they protect, and therefore that the Talmid Chachamim should not have to contribute to the city's defenses. Marsha points out, you know, the mushal that Rish Lakish is using for this, the sand and the sea, is very aptly chosen, because we find that the goyim, the dangers that we face constantly from hostile goyim, are compared to water. Yulul Hashem in this year's capital of the Rebbe, Yulul Hashem Shahoyer Lanu V'kum Aleinu Adam Azayim Mayim Shtafunu, etc. So we would have been overflooded if the Eibishter hadn't protected us. Therefore, it's a very apt mushal that we're constantly threatened by the raging waves of the sea, and you have the tzaddikim, who are compared to sand, hold it back. Therefore, the Shlokesh is saying, in the same way, then the Talmid Chachamim do not need that protection of the wall that you want to put up, and therefore they shouldn't have to contribute to it. So what we said was that, what we said is the number of tzaddikim themselves is less than the sand, because even the whole Jewish people only kachol ashal sfasayam, but the maaseim shal tzaddikim, the individual deeds of the tzaddikim, add up to more than the number of grains of sand, yeah.
All over the world.
All over the world, the Pashtos we're talking about, yeah. Yeah. So that was what the Shlokish told Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya. An interesting historical point, by the way, that may be worth mentioning over here is, usually Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya is identified as the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who composed the Mishnah. The problem with that is that the way Rish Lakish is talking to him, he was one of the Rebbeim of Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish. So you wouldn't have Rish Lakish talking to him like an equal or a superior and telling him, you know, you're doing wrong in doing this because the pasuk is saying such and such. There was more than one Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya. There was the first one, who was the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Then there were later ones of that name after him in the next few generations. So it seems that the Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya over here must have been one of those later ones. So he's already a Talmud compared to Rish Lakish, and therefore Rish Lakish can tell him off and say that he's doing wrong. Right?
They were Nasiim.
That family remained Nasiim for a few hundred years. It started from Hillel. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the seventh generation from Hillel. After him, you had many more generations of them. Eventually, you have Hillel HaNasi, who composed, put together the calendar as we have it. And we find in historical sources there were a few more of his descendants for in the few decades after that who continued to be Nasiim until there was the last one who was recorded in history was Rav Gamliel VII. And he passed away childless, and at that point the Nasiya stopped, and also the Roman emperors, the Byzantine emperors at that point abolished the Nasius.
Also called a Nasi.
What?
Rabbi Akiva was also...
Rabbi Akiva was not a Nasi. Rabbi Akiva was the greatest Talmud Chacham of his time, but no, the Nasi in his time was first Rabbi Gamliel, and later on Rabbi Shimon Gamliel.
Is he from Gerim?
No, you're thinking of Shmaya Rabtalion were from Gerim. Shmaya Rabtalion, either they themselves were Gerim or they were descended from Gerim. No, Hillel himself is descended from David, although there is a, they usually we understand it to mean that he was descended Ben Achaben from David, although there's a Yerushalmi that says that he's actually descended from David only on his mother's side. But yeah.
Malchus from Miriam.
Who was that?
She says
Malchus from Miriam. The Gemara explains that David, that one branch of David's ancestry comes from Miriam. Primarily, we talk about that David is descended from, you have Chetzer and Rom, Aminadav, Nachshon, etc., that whole line. But, so it's a college, doesn't come in there, but the Gemara explains there, the Gemara explains in Sota, that at one point they intermarried with the family of Kalev, who was Miriam's husband, and then David is descended from them. When Rish Lakish came back to Rabbi Yochanan and reported on what he had told Rabbi Yehuda Nasiah, Omalei, so Rabbi Yochanan tells him, Amai lo teim alayim ahai kro. Instead of telling Rabbi Yehuda Nasiah, based on your pasuk, about the tzaddikim and the sand, why don't you tell him a better proof from the following pasuk? Now, what's wrong with his one with the sand? The Rif over here points out that the one with the sand, you could argue that it just because the Eidishta made a special gzera on the sea that it cannot overflood the sand. That doesn't prove for other kinds of things that people should be protected and the Tamar HaChacham should be protected and not need walls. So therefore, Rabbi Yochanan tells him, I'll tell you a pasuk that involves and actually speaks of walls and then implies that the Talmud Chachamim protect people like a wall, and therefore they have no need of a wall of their own. So he says, the pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, Ani Choyma, the Jewish people say about themselves, I am a wall, the Shaddai Kamigdolis, and my breasts are like towers. Ani Choyma means Zu Torah. When it says I am a wall, refers to the Torah, which protects us and surrounds us like a wall. The Shaddai Kamigdolis, and when it says my breasts are like towers, Eilo Tamed Chachamim, that refers to the Tamed Chachamim who teach the people Torah. So they're compared to the way a mother nurses her baby, the same way the Tamed Chachamim teach and then are a mashkiya Torah to the people. Yun Yaakov makes another point as well. They teach each other Torah as well. So it's not just they teach to the people in general, but they teach each other as well. So like they so to speak, they nurse from each other. Yeah. Now Marsha points out like this: when you have a wall around a city, there are two potential things. When you have armies or bandits or whatever coming to attack the city, there might be two things they're after. They might be after money, or they might be after people's lives. Well, so Maharsha says, this pasuk is actually hinting that the Talmid Chachamim are safe against both of them. When it comes to, if they're coming for Iskei Momon, then the Talmid Chacham, they can't steal the Torah from him. There's a well-known story from a Medrash. In fact, there were a bunch of merchants on a boat, and there was a Talmid Chacham over there as well, and the merchants are all talking among themselves and comparing their merchandise, and then they ask that they see the Talmid Chacham doesn't have anything with him, so what are you on this boat for? So what do you do? What's your occupation? He says, I'm a Talmid Chacham. And they all started making fun of him. They think it's useless. Then pirates, whatever, come in and then attack the boat and take everything they have. And meanwhile, the Talmid Chacham gets off the boat, the next place when they reach a port, and he goes to the local base medrash, and they soon find out what he is, and they appoint him the rav of the town. And then all these former merchants, all these rich guys, are all coming to him, begging him to help and then raise money for tzedakah for them. So you see, Taka, my Torah couldn't be stolen, whereas all of your merchandise could. Ki Torah Sacham, because Schoira. So therefore, so the Talmid Chacham is protected. His Torah is protected against no thieves or bandits or armies or whatever can steal it from him. As far as Iskei Nefashos, when we say the Shaddai Kamigdolos, it means Hashem is also compared to a mighty tower that protects us. Migdol Oz Shem Hashem, says the pasuk. The name of Hashem is a mighty tower. And in fact, the word Shaddai in this pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Shaddai means my breasts, but it's also the name Shakai, as in this week's parasha, Bekel Shakai. So it means, in other words, that Hashem protects us, that's the name that shows that Hashem protects us, especially the Shin, the Dalet, and the Yud on the Tefillin. So therefore, so the both of, so that whole pasuk then represents, says Rabbi Yochanan, to the Shlokish, that to the Mechachamim, they don't need the wall, because whether any attackers are coming from Momon or from Nefashis, the Tamar Chachamim are safe from that. Well then, he says to him, so to Rish Lakish, so why don't you tell Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya that pasuk and explain to him because of that, that's a better reason why it's wrong to impose such taxes on the Chachamim. So Vahur Rish Lakish Savalah. So what does Rish Lakish tackle? Why didn't he use that and instead he used the other one about the sand? Because he holds, he darshins the pasuk and Shirashirim can do Dorash Rabbah. He darshins it rather the way Rabbah darshins it. Ani choyma zukneses Yisrael, when it says I am a wall, refers to the Jewish people collectively. V'shodei kamigdolos, and my breasts are like towers. Elo batik nesias, so batim medrashes, that refers to the shawls and the batim medrash, which protect the Jewish people. So in that case, there's nothing in that pasuk about the Tamar Chachamim per se. Of course, the Tamar Chachamim are the ones in the batik nesias, so batim medrashes, but there's nothing specific saying over there that their schos and their Torah protects them or anybody else, and therefore the Shlokish figured if he tells that to Rabbi Yehuda Nesia, then he's going to point out that the Shlokish himself holds that the meaning of the pasuk, and therefore he can't use that as a proof to Rabbi Yehuda Nesia. So Marsha points out that following the same logic as before, again, that they may come from Momon or for Nefashis, primarily when they come and make when the Goyim come and make Zeris against us, most of the time it's on Momon. So therefore, Ani Choyma, the Jewish people collectively, they come to take our money from us. When they come to attack the shuls and batei medrash, that's mainly what they're after, rather than Momon. So it's one or the other, but nothing in there specifically about the Tamar Chachamim being protected from these things. The Gemara continues, Rav Huna or Rav Nachman, Breder of Chista, Shoda Kraga Arabonon. Rav Huna, Breder of Chista, or Rav Nachman, Breder of Chista, imposed a Kraga tax, whatever, on the Chachamim. Karga is this type of tax. It's called in English a poll tax or a head tax. Basically, you live in the country, you have to pay this tax. It has nothing to do with your income, has nothing to do with your real estate or anything, just the fact that you're there, you have to pay a tax. And in Aramaic and in Persian, it's called karga or kraga. So he imposed that tax on the local chachamim as well.
If you're not paying the tax, if you have low income.
So this kind of tax didn't matter whether you have an income or not. In fact, the Gemara talks about in Bava Metzia that sometimes you would have some of the Gemara had mentioned over there. We had it in Ein Yaakov, actually, that you might have one person might pay it on behalf of another, somebody who can't afford it, and then he's actually entitled, al pi halacha, to have that guy do work for them. Because that was the law. That was the civil law at that time, the Persian law. And to that extent, we say dinah d'malchus dinah. So he imposed this tax on the Rabbanim. Now, one thing, by the way, is pointed out that Ramban talks about, that other Rishonim talk about. There is a difference when we're talking about over here this whole business of Tamar Chachamim being exempted from taxation. Besides that, we were talking about what caliber of Tamar Chacham are we talking about, etc. There is also a point that Ramban makes. We're talking about over here when the government just says a general amount of tax that has to be collected from a certain area, and it's up to the local authorities to decide how to apportion it, which was what Rav Huna, Rav Nachman, Breder Rav Chista, was doing over here. The government had told him, you need to raise X amount of tax from this area, and he has to figure out who has to pay what amount. Mashenkin, if each person is being made to pay his own individual amount, then the Chachamim are not necessarily exempt from that. In fact, they refer to it as Gemara and Yuma that talks about there were some places in the Persian Empire where Tamar Chachamim did pay Karga tax and others where they didn't. The Pashtos, we would say, in some places, the local governors did it on an individual basis. You have to pay X amount, you have to pay X amount, like we have nowadays, you know, every person files their own tax return and deals with the IRS individually. As opposed to there would be other places where they said it's a general thing and it's up to the Vada Kahal to decide who pays what.
All the children of the city, usually they don't pay tax, they exempt to pay tax. So the rabbi of that organization also does not pay tax, or he has to pay tax if he has a salary from the organization?
I mean, if the organization is tax exempt, I suppose he is also, but that's a different matter, yeah.
This is a stingy person, it's called a cargo person.
So maybe it's related to this, could be interesting. All right. Kagan, interesting. Okay, anyway. So, Amalei Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok, so Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok says to him, you know, by doing that, you're imposing this kind of tax on Tamei Chachamim when you shouldn't. Avauta Adaraisa Adanvi Adiksuri. You've been over on something that says in all three parts of Tanakh, in Torah and Nevi'im and in Ksuvim, in each one of them, you have a posik that implies that Tamei Chachamim are to be exempt from taxation. Adaraisa, you're being over on something that it says in Chumash, Dichtiv. The pasuk Af Choyvav Amim, Hashem loves the nations. Kok Doshav V'Yadecha, all His holy ones are in your hand. So what does that mean? It means Omer Moshe Lefnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Rashi mentions similarly on the pasuk as one of his explanations over there. It means Moshe is saying to Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam, Afilu B'Shar Shat Mechabev Umas Ha'Olam. Even when you are showing a love and an affection to the Umas Ha'Olam, and you're putting them in charge and you're putting them in power, and Jews are subjugated to them, Yiyu Kok Dosh of Yadecha, nevertheless, all his holy ones, all the Jewish people's holy ones, should still be in your hand under your direct protection. Meaning, in other words, that they shouldn't be subject to the Goyim to that extent, they have to pay taxes. And the pasuk continues, Behem Tuku L'Raglacha, they tuku to your feet. Now, the Rashi explains that tuku means like they crowded themselves in to your feet to receive the Torah. The Gemara has a different explanation. Tony Rabbi Yosef, Eidot Tamar Chachamim, Shemachatet Esraglehen, Me'ir Le'irum, Medina Le'Medina, this refers to the Tamar Chachamim who pound, cut up, or literally, Mechatet means they cut up, they're like they pound with their feet to go from one city to another, and from one country to another, Lumad Torah to learn Torah. Which Marashah says, in that case, that actually gives a practical reason they should be potter from taxes. They never live in one place long enough to be obligated in taxes. The Gemara explains in this sugya that you have to live in a place a certain minimum amount of time to be obligated in that city's tax burden. Well, then, the Talmud Chacham don't stay in any one place long enough because they're going from one place to another to learn Torah from every possible place that they could. An interesting point is, you know, the pasuk says l'raglecha to your feet, but here we're saying that they pound their feet. Ben Yehoyada points out they're using their feet for Torah, therefore their feet become Hashem's feet, so to speak. Yeah. Anyway, so then the pasuk continues yisa midabrei secha. They lift up your words, meaning lisa v'litin b'dvar of shamakim. Why do they travel from one place to another to give and take and engage in discussion of Torah in the words of Hashem? So you see from that pasuk that Moshe is saying that even when the goyim are in power, nevertheless, those who took the kedoshav, the heim tuku l'aglecha, yisamidabrei secha, need to be under your direct protection, Hashem, and not have to be paying taxes to the goyim. So therefore, so you're imposing this chaga tax on them, then you're being over on that. Adnevi, you're being over on something in that connection from the Nevi'im. Dichtiv, a pasuk says in Hesheya, Gam ki yisnu bagoyim, even when they yisnu among the nations, first we'll quote the pasuk in full, and then we'll explain it. Gam ki yisnu bagoyim, even when they yisnu in the nations, after akabtzeim, now I will gather them, vayachelu ma'at, and they will yachelu, which the simple meaning means to tremble a little bit, mimasa melech sarim, from the burden of kings and princes. So Rashi explains in Parshat Pshat in context of the Psukim, it's talking about the Jewish people are going, especially the Aseres HaShvatim, are going around from one nation to another and offering them bribes. So Yisnu Meloshin Esnan Zoyna, like they're offering them bribes and fees to be their allies. And Hashem says, even though they're acting and they're degrading themselves so much, nevertheless, Hashem says, Ata Akab, saying, I am ready to gather the Jewish people in from Golus as soon as they make themselves worthy of it. If they don't, then they're going to have to spend a little while in Golus and be trembling and fearful of the burdens of kings and princes. That's the Pasuk Trat and the Pasuk according to Rashi. On the Pasuk, other Mephoshim have slightly different nuances of what it means. In any case, but here the Gemara says, Amar Rava or Ula, Pasuk Zeh B'Loshan Aramis Nemer. We can understand also a key word of this Pasuk, the word Yisnu, to be a word in Aramaic. And therefore it's related to the word Tonu Rabbanon. Therefore, we can douch in the pasuk as follows. Im kulam yisnu bagoyim, or tonu kulu, if all of them, tonu, learn Torah, or all of them, or even most of them, after akabtzeim, then Hashem says, now I am ready to gather them in from Golos. The im ma'ot mehem, but if there were only, as the pasuk continues, v'yachelu ma'ot mimasa melech sarim, the im ma'at mehem, if it's only a minority of people who are learning Torah, v'yachelu mimasa melech sarim, nevertheless, they will be able to set aside, they will be able to cancel the burden of kings and princes. Rashi explains in this case, yachelu is meloshon lo yachal dvorei, a person is not allowed to violate his word with a neder. So then, it means they can violate the burden of kings and princes, they're not chayiv in it. And now, Marsha points out, the pasuk doesn't say anything about most of them learning Torah, but since the end of the pasuk continues v'yachelu ma'ot, which is talking about a minority, then we understand the first part of the pasuk, gam ki yisnu ragoyim, is talking about if a majority of the Jewish people, or all of them, are doing this. This is, by the way, also, you know, what you have in Pirkei Avos, called makabel ol of ol Torah, ma'avirin menu, ol malchus v'ol derech eretz. That's what it means. In other words, that the burden of the kings of their taxes, and then the burden of derech eretz, of having to make a living, is removed from a person who learns Torah properly. You have, by the way, in many of the old Tilos Hashem Siddurim, you'll find a footnote over there. It says Pirush, that says that means that Tzibur Noisa B'Shvila Schoiva Samadina. The Tzibur will bear the burdens of the government on his behalf. Now, based on our Gemara, that is a true point. However, that footnote was actually added by the censors because they couldn't stand the idea that a person should be free from Earl Malchus. So they kind of reinterpreted it. But it is based on our Gemara. There is a certain validity to it. Anyway, so we see, therefore, so he says to Rav Nachman or Rav Huna bar Rav Chisda that you're being over on this pasuk as well, the way that Rav or Ulav Darshaned it, which implies that the Tamina Chacham, even if they're a minority, are to be exempt from taxes to the kings. Adichtuvi, you're being over on something in Ksuvim. Dichtiv, pasuk says in Ezra, this is part of a letter that when Ezra is bringing his group of Jews to Eretz Yisrael a few years after the second Beis Hamikdash finished being built, so he got a letter from Dariovesh that spells out what his authority is in Eretz Yisrael and so on and so forth, and the pasuk says, Dariovesh orders his ministers in Eretz Yisrael, Minda b'loy v'haloch lo shalit l'mirma aleihun. You do not have any authority to impose on them minda, bloy, or halach, tax, which are various kinds of taxes that the Gemara is now going to define. Who are the them? What? So they were coming from Babel. Rashi explains that this refers to the people of the Anshe Knesset Hagdolah, which, of course, are top level, Tamid HaChamim, so then that shows that Tamid HaChamim are not to be taxed. Tosfos says a little differently. It's talking about those who are coming to build and to build the Beis Mikdash, or actually the Rashash points out, to be more exact, the pasuk refers to the Kohenim, Leviim, the singers, the gatekeepers in the Beis Mikdash, the Nesinim, etc. They're all busy doing Avodas HaKodesh. They're all working in the Beis Mikdash, and therefore Dariovesh announces that they're to be exempt from taxes. Well, by the same token then, those who are learning Torah, which is also Malachas Shemayim, also have to be exempted from it. So what are these three types of taxes? V'amar Rav Yehuda, minda zumanos hamelach. The minda refers to the percentage for the king. This is, again, every year the king is entitled to a certain percentage of people's income and whatnot. That kind of thing is called minda. And in later times it's called menos hamelach, the amount for the king. Bloy zukesef gugolta. Bloy is what we called before the poll tax, what we called before kraga. The individual tax that each person has to pay. The halach, the arnona, and halach refers to a tax called arnona. Rashi says this is every year they would have to give the government 1/10 of the newborn animals of that year. So just like we have Maisa Behemoth, so Lahavdo governments in those times would impose a similar kind of tax. The Ran in Jordan gives an interesting explanation. So why was that tax called Arnona? We find in the Psukim that the river Arnon was the border between Moav and Eretz Yisrael. Originally it was the border between Moav and the land of Sichon, and later on when the Jewish people took over the land of Sichon, then it became the border over there. So Arnon was basically shared in partnership between the Jewish people and Moav. Therefore the word Arnona came to be something that's shared in partnership, as in the idea is, so to speak, the king is a partner in your herd of animals, and he's entitled to a certain percentage of them every year. Other Mefoshim explain that Tosfos brings over here, the Oruch brings, that Arnona comes from a word that means a meal. When the king is passing through from place to place, then the people, the locals, are expected to provide him and his entourage with food, and that kind of thing is called Arnona, which in fact fits very well with the fact that the Pasuk calls it Helech, Meloshon going, as in when the king goes and travels from place to place, and the people have to provide for him and his entourage. Whatever the case, the point is, though, Yavish is saying that they, the Anshe Knesset Agdolo, or the people working for the Beis Mikdash, whatever, are not to be charged any of these kinds of taxes. So you see, says Rav Nachum Yitzchak, that you can't charge any of these kinds of taxes to Talmid Chachamim.
How are you taxing?
What?
How are you taxing?
Yeah, well, no, any tax, any of these taxes, any of them. So that's what we're saying. So any of these taxes, but again, subject to, the Ran points out over here, you have Chidushi Aran printed over here on the page, in the Ein Yaakov, who brings from Rabbeinu Hanan along the Ramban, that it's different again when it is imposed individually on each person, like you have nowadays, where every person files their own tax return, then that's different. We're talking about in those days where they would often have a collective kind of thing, and then the local Vada Kohol, the local whoever, would have to decide who has to pay how much, then you're not to impose it on the Tamina Chachamim. Further on, the Gemara continues talking about the relationship between the Talmid Chachamim and the Amei Aretz in this regard. The Gemara says, Rebbe Posach Oitzris B'Shnei Batzoris. One time, in years of famine, Rebbe opened up a storehouse. His Rebbe, we know, was fabulously rich. We learned about it a little bit in Bava Metzia. So now he had storehouses of food, and he opened them to make it available during a famine. V'omar, but he said, Yikonsu Balin Mikra, those who have at least learnt Tanakh can come in. Balin Mishnah, those who have learnt Mishnah. Balin Talmud, the people who have learnt Talmud, the analysis of Mishnahis. Balin Halacha, the people who focus on Halacha. Balin Haggadah, so even the people who just focus on Agadah. Aval Amea Oretz Al Yikonsu. However, the Amea Oretz should not come in. Now, why not? Does he expect the Amea Oretz to starve? So there's a couple of points in this regard. Marsha first of all brings like this. The Gemara tells us in Tainus that when the world is in Tsar, you're not allowed to go and enjoy yourself. You have a halacha that comes from that. A person is not allowed to do Tashma Shamita. In times of famine, for example, we learn that from Yosef having had his children before Betenem Tovish Nasarov. So now what happens is, Marisho explains, the Amei Aretz don't take that attitude. They tend to say, okay, everybody else is having a hard time of it. So what? We'll live it up. So therefore, it's not right that they should be given food. Let them also understand what it means to be hungry. And suffer together with the tzibur. That's one point. Marsha brings another point as well, which is he brings from the Beis Yosef, who in turn brings from the Ritzvah. The vort is because it's in English you have the expression, it's a zero sum game, meaning what you give to the Amei Aretz is not going to be available to the Talmid Chacham. So therefore, he has a right to say, let the Amei Aretz not take, because we need to preferentially give to the Talmid Chachamim. When it comes to other kinds of things, where the giving to the Amei Aretz is not going to impinge anything on the Talmid Chachamim, by all means, you have to help them out as well. Okay. Anyway, but he says, so the Amei Aretz should not enter. Dochak Yonasan ben Amram ben Nich. What? Into the storehouses. They shouldn't be able to expect to get any of what Rebbe is handing out over there. Well, Dochak Yonasan ben Amram ben Nichnas. Yonasan ben Amram, who was one of Rebbe's Talmidim, pushed his way in anyway. But he didn't want to present himself as a Talmid Chacham. He didn't want to get covered or anything, any hanah from his Torah. You know, we have in Pirkei Avos, you're not supposed to make the Torah, Kaudim Lachtachba, and this Yonasan ben Amram was taking that quite literally. Omalei, so he says, Rebbe, Parnaseni, Rebbe, please support me. Omalei, so Rebbe asked him, Bni, Karisa, have you at least learned Tanakh? Omalei, Lav. And Yonasan ben Amram says, no. Shonisa, have you learned Mishnah? Omalei, Lav. Omalei, so Rebbe says, and came by Ma'af Anasecha. Then with what am I supposed to support you? What have you done that should make you worthy of my support? So Yonasan ben Amram says, Parnaseni ka'kelev, Parnaseni ka'orev. Fine, but give me food like you would to a dog, or like you would to a, like is done to a dog and to a raven. So Rashi points out like this. The dog, the Gemara mentions in Shabbos, that people don't usually feed dogs. We're not talking about nowadays, like when lots of people have dogs as pets. Back then, dogs were basically strays. So people didn't usually feed them, and often they'd beat them with a stick and drive them away. So the Eibishter knows that they have very little to eat, and so he makes it That he makes it that the food that they eat stays in their stomach. They have a very, very slow digestive system, so the food stays in their stomach for a couple of days. That way they can get the maximum nutrition and the maximum full feeling out of it. So we see the Eibishter has Rachmanos on the dog. As far as the raven, we say every day in davening, Livnei Erev, Asher Yikro, what happens is, the Gemara explains that the ravens, the adult ravens are black. The children are born white. The parents don't recognize them as their own, so they refuse to feed them. What the Eibishter provides them, the Eibishter makes that worms come from their own waste, and they eat those worms until they mature, and then their parents start taking care of them.
The bird can forage for itself.
What?
If it
wants. No, the adult bird can forage for itself, but the baby ravens cannot, but the Eibishter provides for them. So that's what we say in davening, Noisim b'lehem alachm, l'vnei erev, asher yikro, that the Eibishter provides for all of them even when they're helpless themselves. Marsha points out, Tosfos points out, the word behema in that posik is the same gematria as kelim. So we actually have a remez in that posik to both the dog and the raven being supported by Hashem. So therefore, so he's saying, support me like the way the Eibishter supports them. Why is he mentioning Dafka, those creatures? So there's a number of different explanations. Marsha points out, here we were just talking about that the Amei Ha'aretz are enjoying themselves and then living it up during times of famine, unlike the Tamei Chacham, who know that they have to have that during the Tzar or the Tzibur. Well, during the Mabul is another such example of that. It was also, all of the creatures on the Teva were also to have relations, but three creatures violated it, two of them being the raven and the dog. And nevertheless, Noach still continued to provide for them in the Teva. Therefore, Yonasan ben Amram says to Rebbe, then at least, even if you're going to think of me as one of the Amei Ha'aretz who lives it up during this time, at least then consider me no worse than the dog or the raven.
Chum
was the third one, right? There's a number of other explanations that Mephoshim explain why after these. We find that ravens supplied food to Eliyahu HaNavi during a drought. They brought him bread and meat. The pasuk says the dogs didn't bark at the Jewish people when they left Mitzrayim. So therefore, like they at least helped out the tzaddikim, or at least didn't interfere with them. And therefore, he's saying, fine, even if I'm an artist, I'm not the kind who interferes with and harasses the chachamim, and for that I deserve to be fed. And a few other different explanations among the Mephoshim why he picked these two animals. Okay, Pirnasoi, so Rebbe gave in and gave him food. La'acha sheyotza, after he left, Yosef Rebbe v'kam etzar, Rebbe was sitting and feeling bad. Omar, he says, Oyli shenasati piti v'amoretz. Woe to me that I gave my bread to an amoretz. After all, again, as Marsha says, first of all, that bread could have instead gone to a Taman Chacham. There's also a point, for example, why did I have to give him my bread? I could have given him cheaper food. I could have given him something more appropriate to the animals that he mentioned, for example. And also, why did I give him bread? He didn't necessarily wash, but if he didn't say a bracha, etc. Omel the fun of Reb Shimon Berebi, but Reb Shimon Berebi says, Reb Shimon says to him, Shema Yonasan ben Amram Talminchahu, maybe this one who you didn't recognize, maybe it's actually your Talmud Yonasan ben Amram. Now you have to realize Rebbe had thousands of Talmudim, he probably didn't remember all their faces. In his whole life, he never wanted to take any covered from the Torah, as in fact it says in Pirkei Avos. Bodku achrav motzu, they checked into it and they found, sure enough, it was him. Omer Rebbe, you come to our call for you. Rebbe says, I know. So Rebbe says, fine, you know what, everybody can enter. We don't want to have, maybe what if there might be other Tamei Chachamim who pretend to be Amei Ha'aretz like he did. I don't want to deprive them. So fine, let everybody come in. So we'll continue tomorrow, Bezat Hashem, and talk about why Rebbe wanted to discriminate against Amei Ha'aretz like that. But yeah.
Okay.
No, because Karisa comes first. You first learn Tanakh, generally. You first learn Tanakh as the basis before at least Chumash, before you start with Mishnah. Sometimes it happens, vice versa. Sometimes you have. The Bali Mishnah are not such experts in Pesukim. So, yeah, it could go either way. Yom Yom Mashiach of Ge'olah, of Beis Tevis. So the Rebbe was talking about in a sicha that in order to accomplish to bring the Moshe Mashiach, we have to accept the Achlotas Toivas. So this would especially be people take on the Achlotas Toivas to learn the whole Torah or in Lakutei Torah from beginning to end. And through learning this kind of Torah, then we'd bring closer the Hamshach of a Poil. It was actually one of this week's project. Lakutei Sichas was about the uniqueness of the Alter Rebbe's Shitta, that he brings a light into Torah, into Torah's Achsidus, by making it that's now understandable to the human brain, as opposed to before him. It was the Rebbe's before him and his contemporaries didn't really focus on that kind of thing. There is, in fact, nowadays there is a multi-year project to learn Torah or look at your Torah over a period of a couple of years each week's parsha, each week's finish of parsha. Okay, continuing with halachas and Netilas Yadayim in the morning. So we're talking about you have to wash from a keli. But now, if you go and take a keli of water and swish your hands in it a couple of times, that does not help to take off the ruach ra. Just the opposite. You put your hands in there the first time, and they still have the ruach ha-tumah, then it makes all the water tumah. So now it becomes like mei shoshkin, now it becomes like wastewater. However, though, if you did it three different times in three different bodies of water, or you do it in a river, which is considered to that extent, like different bodies of water, because the water keeps on flowing, then it's a suffix whether that counts as Netilas Yadayim, whether it takes off the Ruach Ra. So better to do a proper Netilas Yadayim, because maybe it only goes away by pouring from a keli. If you don't have any alternative, I guess then the implication would be that you just rely on them.